Yay. Take us inside. I'm delighted to Daniel. Thank you.
Yeah. Likewise. So I'm here with Mark Goffney, and you've co-authored a forthcoming book. I think it's coming out April 2nd, maybe. We're at the end of March right now. And it's titled First Principles and First Values, 42 Propositions on Cosmorotic Humanism, the Metacrisis, and the World to Come. And you co-authored this with Zach Stein, and I think also the help of Ken Wilber, if I'm not mistaken, under the name David Judah Temple. So I thought we'd start there. Who is DJT, and why did you choose this character?
Yeah, DJ. Well, the truth is, David just called me this morning, actually. And we actually were talking about kind of how to kind of answer that question. And I really follow his, you know, guidance, of course. But more seriously, we decided to create a kind of pseudo-anonymous authorship. And I want to emphasize that, excuse me, it is pseudo-anonymous in the sense that in the book, I'm just picking up a copy. In the book, we actually very clearly, you know, say Mark Goffney, you know, Zach Stein, Ken Wilber, you know, so it's very clearly, so we're not hiding.
Right.
So, you know, because, you know, in this strange web world of broken information ecologies we're in, oh my God, they're trying to hide. No, we're not hiding authorship at all. We're being very clear about authorship. But the nature of this moment is that most of the writing happening is happening, even when it's good, within the context of rivalrous conflict governed by Wendler's metrics.
Mm-hmm.
I'm gonna become a writer, I'm gonna become a major intellectual, you know, I'm a galaxy mind, you know, I'm the wisest of the wise, which of course, strange, only applies to me. So I don't know why anyone would think it applies to them, which is of course a very strange thing. It's a little joke. But there's, you know, in other words, we need purity here. We need purity and we need devotion. And that now I kind of get serious, meaning we are facing a metacrisis, which is real, of a kind and a nature and a potential set of results that are unparalleled in human history. And if we think that we're going to be able to deal with that within kind of the normal context of kind of egoic games, you know, finite games, if you will, right? It's not going to work. We need infinite games. And infinite games means there needs to be a breath of eternity. It needs to be a breath of the Tao, right? And one of the ways I translate the Tao, particularly, it's a particular reading of Taoism, is I call the Tao the field of value, right? The infinite field of value. And if you think about, my friend, think about the sutras.
Mm-hmm.
Who wrote the sutras? Who wrote the Bible?
Right.
Who wrote the Zohar? Right. Who wrote the Upanishads? Right. And actually, Sorkin, as a sociologist at Harvard for quite a long time, and is actually quite a deep thinker, you know, he points out that there's different forms of authorship, and that at key seminal moments in history, right, what moves history is a new form of authorship.
Right.
And so, on the one hand, David J. Temple is Mark Goffney and Zach Stein. And on this particular book, we were joined by my co-founder at the center and our dear friend, Ken Wilber. And we might be joined in other books by other figures. There's a bunch of other figures that are working with us. So there'll be particular people who are, you know, kind of wonderful, who will join in particular projects. But Zach and I will be the consistent, you know, God is willing, the consistent frame. But the idea is, this is not going to work as a Mark Goffney egoic project or a Zach Stein egoic project or a Ken Wilber egoic project. There's
right.
got to be something bigger happening here.
This actually kind of reminds me of the lore in Bitcoin and why Bitcoin is such a powerful movement. Like, one of the reasons is nobody knows who Satoshi Nakamoto is. And
right.
there's something like beyond a person at the root of this whole phenomenon. I mean, in this case, people know who David Judah Temple is, but I guess what you're saying is it's kind of an ego removing move, or it's like a less egoic place to come from when putting together an intellectual work.
Yeah. No. Yes, brother. And by the way, no one knows I'm Satoshi, so we're going to keep that quiet.
Yeah. Right. But, I'll edit this part out.
All right. We got it. But I want to bring, if I can, I want to invoke these two words that we mentioned in passing before, which I was actually talking to Zach about earlier today. And one is the word purity. The other is the word devotion. And maybe add a third word that Lionel Trilling loved, which is sincerity.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, all three of those words are words that have fallen into disrepute, you know, in mainstream intelligentsia or leadership circles. We almost award them as booby prizes, right, to people who aren't sufficiently successful, right, in the rivalrous conflict governed by win-lose metrics world, right? He's not very successful, but he's a very devoted father.
Right. He's very sincere.
He's very, right. She, you know, right. That's right. She's really, you know, his wife, she's really not beautiful, but she's such a devoted wife, right? Mm-hmm. You know, very, very sincere or, you know, he's not very smart, but he has such a pure heart.
Right.
Right. So we've actually taken the three most important words and we've relegated them to booby prizes.
Well, it's almost like they're low status. Right? Like being devoted, being sincere. It's like a low status move.
Right. It's a low status move. And we wanted to offer David J. Temple with a great amount of sincerity, with as much purity as we could muster, and with a kind of radical devotion, you know, to the field of value, to the future, who desperately needs our voice. And perhaps last sentence, and in some sense, David J. Temple is, of course, much larger than Zach and I, or between Zach Ken and I in this first book. But David J. Temple is all of us, right, who are deeply facing into, refusing to look away from this moment in which we're poised between utopia and dystopia.
Mm-hmm.
We're not willing to look away from it, right? So we're not deniers. We're also haven't gone down the road of, you know, my erstwhile friend, I didn't know him well, but we spoke a bunch of times, good man, Michael Dowd, who kind of went along with many people, he passed recently, suddenly, doomers, kind of a denier move, or is it denial, which is where most people are, one way or the other. Then there's the doomer move, right? There's actually overshoot, right? Overshoot's kind of the text that's often cited as the Bible of the doomer movement, but basically there's nothing to be done. Let's grieve the fall,
right?
Which there's quite a lot of information to support. That's not a strange idea. That's actually a quite a rational position if you actually look at the information. But it's wrong ultimately. And what we're saying is no. Actually, you know, if we would say it in religious terms, right, I would say God is the possibility of possibility.
Mm-hmm.
And God is the evolutionary impulse. God is the field of value. And the possibility of possibility means that there's a deep hope. There's a deep possibility that evolution is on the move, right? That actually new ideas and new emergent forms, ultimately what we're calling in this book, First Principles and First Values, a new vision of value, a new story of value, a universal grammar of value, of intrinsic value rooted in evolving first principles and first values actually has the capacity to change the course of history. And Daniel, that's not naive. That's not unrealistic. It's actually exactly how reality works.
Right, right.
Right. But without first principles and first values, without a field of value, without a grammar of value, and we can talk about why that's the case, we don't actually have a chance in response to the meta crisis.
Yeah. So let's unpack some of this. And I think the subtitle is actually a really good place to start because some of the key terms are present in there. Maybe you can tell the listeners what cosmorotic humanism is, what the meta crisis is, and what the world to come is. You kind of referenced the meta crisis, but maybe spell that out.
Yeah, totally. No, that's great. So let's take it step at a time. So we're in this world of exponential technology, which is exploding. The exponential technologies are exterior in their nature. They're deployed in all sorts of exterior forms.
Exterior as in not...
As in information technologies, as in weaponized drones, as in artificial intelligence, right? Of, you know, both the first wave that birthed social media, right, kind of the second wave of social media that's birthed the like of ChatGPT-4 and the other kind of new forms of, you know, artificial intelligence, machine intelligence that are exploding throughout the system today. So those are all exteriors, right? Those are all new technologies that transform the way we experience reality. And I mean, the easiest access to that would be even something like Twitter, right? Twitter, which used to be Twitter and is now X, right, is a new form of talking, right, which creates a worldwide conversation, which is limited to 140 characters, right, which has this, you know, unimaginable amount of people attracted to it, but which also creates enormous polarization, which actually downgrades something in the very nature of society, right, which actually... You know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So there's an enormous amount of, you know, when I was with my son and my partner, KK, and we spent a week together on kind of father-son trip, just the men plus Christina, who took care of us. So it was kind of the men plus Christina. So it's kind of like Thoreau was in Walden's pond, but his mother brought him lunch. No one tells you that. Right. It's like, so we spent this incredible week together. We just had an incredibly beautiful week. And my son, who I'm madly in love with, Zion, was literally living in this immersive environment, right? In which he had several screens going at a time, all the time, until dad said, stop, right? But in other words, and he lived inside. In other words, we're not living with new tools. We have actually an immersive environment, which is the instrument of communication, right? Which is looking at you, surveilling you as you look at it. You think you're looking at the screen. The screen is actually looking at you, right? Creating a personality profile about you, right? Organizing and trying to actually direct both your field of desire and ultimately your field of action, all invisible to you, right? So that's one example of technologies, right, which create kind of the potential death of our humanity. So that's one kind of existential risk, one kind of meta crisis. But then a second meta crisis in which we have an entire vector of technologies from artificial intelligence, right, to weaponized drones available to rogue non-state actors, right, to, you know, methane gas under the tundra, right, without any kind of body to actually address that, et cetera. I mean, I could go down the 15 vectors right now of existential risk or, you know, dead zones in the ocean larger than Australia, et cetera, et cetera. So, which actually speaks directly to a collapse of ecosystems. Right? It's a fundamental collapse of ecosystems, which actually creates a kind of extinction kind of event, which is the death of humanity. So there's two kinds of metacrisis, the death of humanity, a potential new extinction event. We've had extinction events before, but this would be the end of humanity as we know it as a viable possibility. That's what's so important. In other words, when in Toby Ord's book on existential risk, you know, where he kind of tries to go through the and crack the numbers and kind of do the kind of the hard actuarial tables, as one might say, the possibility of the death of humanity is shockingly high.
Right.
Right. And you take even something like artificial intelligence, where you have about 50%, right, of the leaders in the field, right, who view artificial intelligence itself as an existential risk. And yet, because of the race to the bottom, right, right,
they're rushing to develop it.
Multipolar traps in which no one's willing to step out of the race.
Yeah.
Right. You create, right, this rush to develop something. I mean, it's actually, it's unimaginable. I mean, if we say this and just move on, it's just unimaginable. That's you have this race to generate a technology which the leaders of the technology itself say may destroy humanity, because everyone is saying multipolar trap, well, someone else is going to do it anyways, so I might as well do it. And of course, the windfall profits and the short-term benefits are obviously coloring the conversation. And the amount of people involved, Daniel, there's about 200 people involved at the core. Pretty much all of them white males, you know, between, you know, 22 and 50, somewhere around there. I mean, generally, I mean, it's a, you know, but generally even younger, right? Kind of more like 22 to 40, right? Generally, they are ill-adjusted, somewhat traumatized, right? Have, you know, kind of tragic or non-sexual lives. They haven't been able to work out their sexuality. They haven't been able to work out their relationship to the feminine. Mm-hmm. So there's this tiny group of people, and it's actually shocking, right, who are not elected, right, unimaginably poor philosophers, right, meaning without any depth, right, you know, in something other than their very narrow sectors, right? So there's this kind of deformation, right, where there's this very, very narrow specialized depth. But actually, based on that narrow specialized depth, they are without regulation, because no one exactly even knows how to regulate them, because actually a very small amount of companies have actually employed the 10,000 key data scientists in the world. So there's actually no one to even interrogate the algorithm. And even something that we saw happen recently in OpenAI, where our young friend Sam, you know, Altman, you know, stepped out for a period of time, or he was stepped out for a period of time, but he was stepped out by a group of people that were on the board that were concerned about existential risk, right? And in the end, Sam, you know, aligning with Microsoft, Satya, right, basically stepped back in, and essentially that was a signal, all breaks off. And if you notice, where are we now? We're now on March 23rd, 2024, when we're having this conversation. So if you notice, my friend, about 8-9 months ago, for about 3 or 4 months, so we were in 2023, kind of in towards the winter, spring, summer, there was an explosion of articles all over the world in the mainstream press talking about the exit. For the first time, the word existential risk broke into the public. Yeah. And if you've noticed, they've almost disappeared.
Right.
Isn't that interesting? So there's this, they break out. The Altman thing happens at OpenAI. There's this shift, and all those voices have now been quieted. There's no solution. So there's no agreement that's in place, right? We haven't solved the problem, but it's actually been moved by intention based on the interlocking sets of relationships that actually not a conspiracy of a bunch of, you know, green lizards, but just the interlocking, self-optimizing, rivalrous conflict governed by win-lose metrics that actually drives the entire system, which is complicated, not complex, meaning the parts aren't actually in coherence with being omni-considerate and omni-responsible, Bucky Fuller's term, right, for the sake of the whole, that's not happening. And so it's disappeared, like literally disappeared from the headlines. And anyone who's been tracking can actually track when it appeared. You can kind of find it in your body. It just exalts that existential risk is in the mainstream and it's gone.
Right.
Any real conversation. So that's what we mean by the meta crisis, right? So it's both last sentence, and this, that we've only handled the first of your three inquiries, but let's hold here. So the meta crisis is the exponential technologies, which are exterior, which are dissociated or alienated from a parallel deepening of interior technologies. And by interior technologies, I mean value, which is not Christian or Muslim or jihadic or Jewish values, but it's value, that we live in a field of value. So we've lost access to that, and we can come back to that. That's actually what I'm most interested in talking about. But we've But the idea that there's a field of value that we live in, that there are first principles and first values that are non-dogmatic, right? Not a pre-modern dogmatic claim, but that we actually have an intrinsic sense of being in a shared field of value, that is what I would call an interior technology.
Right. And is that, so great articulation of the stakes, right? The meta crisis.
Yeah.
And is cosmoerotic humanism DJT's answer to what that field of value is?
Great. That's fantastic. So exactly. So cosmoerotic humanism is the name we've given to the new story of value. Right, governed by first principles and first values, right, rooted in this field of value. And I want to just, with permission, Daniel, just double click on one. When we say new story of value, we don't mean new story, right, in the sense that it's just a story.
Yeah.
Right?
It's a story with a capital S.
Start with a capital S, and one of the major conversations, and my old frames I was wearing are cutting into my face, so I'm going to switch frames here. So sorry about that. Oh, yeah. Right, they happen to be on the desk as well. Who's that other guy here? one of the things we talk about in First Principles and First Values is that story itself, the narrative arc of reality, is actually not a human contrivance. The notion of story is not a human contrivance. It's actually part of the structure of reality. Mm-hmm. In other words, reality is not merely a fact. Reality is a story.
Yeah, this is something old school Jordan Peterson did a really good job of articulating, like the importance of myth and how it's actually a more useful frame of interpreting reality than simply reducing things down to material facts that are
so
separate
from
narrative.
Yeah, so I'm going to tenderly take issue here a little bit.
Oh, please.
Jordan and I know of each other, but we've never met. We have a mutual friend who's talked to us about each other over the last year or two. Warren Farrell, but we don't know each other, and I don't know Jordan's work well. So but I did, you know, when he kind of came into prominence, I took a look at his book on maps of meaning. Mm-hmm. The way he understands story is exactly not what I'm saying.
Oh, please.
I want to be precise. Yeah. So Jordan is looking at story as this kind of useful structure. It's a better way to understand reality. Mm-hmm. And that's correct. So Jordan and I share that. But we're saying something
more ambitious,
much more dramatic. It's much more, and actually, with lots of respect for my friend Jordan, more important, right? Because it's more fundamental and it changes the game. Because what I'm saying is, and what David's saying is, David J. Temple, what we're saying here is that actually story itself is a first principle and first value of reality. In other words, I mean, the way the lineage would say it, let's say in the lineage of Solomon and the Hebrew wisdom tradition, they would say, I'll translate from Aramaic, God loves stories. Mm-hmm. But what they mean by that is, that's a clever way of saying that actually the reason you and I think in terms of stories is not because of some random emergence that happened to happen through a random process of evolution. It's part of a pointless universe that has no rhyme or reason, right? That's chaotic. That's, you know, a tale told by an idiot full of sounds and fury signifying nothing. And just happens at all. So it's story. And of course, that point is the point that postmodernism made. Mm-hmm. Paradoxically, Jordan's taking issue with postmodernism, but actually postmodernism's point is it's all stories. No. So we're saying no. The fact that it's all stories is not because it's just stories. It's because story is the structure of reality. And actually, story always means there's a causal nexus of events. A leads to B, which leads to C, number one. Number two, there's a telos. There's a plot line. Mm-hmm. It's going somewhere. Number three, there's a desire. There's a desire for something to happen, number three. Number four, there's some dimension of freedom in the story. Otherwise, it would be a tech manual.
Right? It's not predetermined.
Right, there's some amount of freedom. And finally, number five, right, there's often, although not always, a crisis which generates the next stage of the plot line.
Right.
So those five elements, which I just casually mentioned now, actually took me about a decade, right? But those are the five dimensions of story that live all the way down and all the way up the evolutionary chain. And it's very beautiful. In other words, whether you're in the world of subatomic particles or whether you're in the world of the biosphere, the world of matter, or the world of mind, or excuse me, of biology, or in the world of the depth of the self-reflective human mind, so matter, life, depth of self-reflective human mind, all of those three are governed by a narrative arc, story. Mm-hmm. And the movement from matter to life to mind to ever deeper levels of depth of self-reflective human mind and heart, that telos, that plot line, is itself a story.
Right.
It's a narrative arc to the whole thing.
It's stories all the way down. I'm picturing like a fractal structure of stories.
Stories all the way down and an evolving story all the way up,
mm-hmm.
which means that just like we explode into the world of matter, which is also made up of what matters, meaning even in the world of matter, there's a field of value. What matters means there's a field of value. So there's value at play between protons, neutrons, and electrons. Just like there's mathematical value, but there's also value in terms of what we desire and what we're allured to and what gives us a feeling of more wholeness. Does that sound familiar? Pretty human. So
yeah,
of course, it's an evolving story, right? So one of the reasons, I don't know if you're married or not, right?
Nope.
You probably wouldn't go out with a proton.
Wouldn't know how,
right? It's kind of like, right? Now I'm into electrons this week. No, probably not, right? So we're not saying that the field of value and the experience of allurement, right, at the level of subatomic particles is the same interior experience as it is with Daniel when he's on a date. But we are saying there's a continuum between them.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning there's an evolution of eros. There's an evolution of love, but it's love all the way down and love all the way down. It's eros all the way down and eros all the way up. And eros is, and we've tried to define in this book, and this is answering your question of what cosmotic humanism is, eros is, in its interior science equation that we unpack in the First Principles and First Values book, eros equals the experience of radical aliveness, desiring, not just seeking, it's actually an experience of desire, desiring ever deeper contact and ever greater wholeness.
Yeah. So I think this is a good place to connect it to something like very first person.
Yeah, totally.
Because I think a lot of people, if they slow down and pay attention to the words you said just there, a lot of people can identify moments in their life where they felt more radical aliveness as opposed to less, or they felt desire and they've as a result felt like their life is justified, or their, you know, you might use words like things feel meaningful or purposeful
We didn't, and as in those moments, we don't answer the questions. The questions fall away.
Exactly. And even if your life consists of some amount of suffering and pain, it feels justified. It feels acceptable. In fact, it feels like in a story, you don't want it just to be neutral. There's ups and downs. You want trauma. You want conflict. And everything just kind of clicks in a manner that feels, I would say, even just very psychologically healthy.
You feel like your life has been validated.
Yeah.
And it's been validated because, so can we do a deep dive here for a second, for a minute? So it's very beautiful. So you asked, let's go back. So Daniel asked, what's cosmorotic humanism? So cosmorotic humanism is the experience that the cosmoerotic universe lives in me. Humanism, right? The dignity, humanism is also about human dignity. Mm-hmm. My human dignity derives from the fact that, for example, just as one example, the sexuality moving through me is not an aberrant force. It's not merely some fetishization of an early trauma that's now gotten translated. And isn't it a shame, right, that, you know, that I've got this to work with and thank God no one knows about it. And if people really, no. I mean, that might be true as well, but, you know, bracket that for a second. But no, the sexual force that moves in me is an expression of something that existed for 12 billion years before sex. Before sex, there was 12 billion years of eros.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, sex is 12 billion years later, but sex is another disclosure of the currency of life that desires ever deeper contact an ever greater wholeness. And you immediately, Daniel, very beautifully, you immediately kind of sensed the first person resonance. And you said, no, let's take this first person, because you said, oh, I know that. Right, right. I have a desire for ever deeper contact and ever greater wholeness. And in the lineage of Solomon, we call that tshuka, the radical desire at the heart of reality. But Whitehead, who writes Principia Mathematica with George Bertrand Russell at Cambridge, he doesn't want to talk about desire because he's an Englishman in Cambridge, so it doesn't go well. But so he talks about the appetition of the cosmos. Cosmos has appetites.
Yeah.
What does cosmos have appetites for? Value. Cosmos desires value. And Eros is not neutral. Eros is the core value of cosmos. That's gorgeous. It's like, it complete changes the game. It's a Da Vinci game changer. So we're not going to respond to the meta crisis by denial or by being a doomer, but by having the dawn, we're just going to stay with the alliterative D's, you know what I mean? The dawn, right, of a kind of new Da Vinci moment where we tell a new story of value based on the best scientific, interior and exterior science information available, which we realize that reality is Eros all the way up and all the way down. It desires ever deeper contact and ever greater wholeness, from the subatomic to the biological to the depth of the human world, in ever, ever increasing beautiful and stunning depth, ever more potency. And of course, whenever there's more potency, there's also more pathology, right? Atomic bombs do worse things than bows and arrows, but there's a vector of cosmos. There's a currency. There's a telos. It's a telerotic universe, and that lives in me, cosmerotic humanism. So Daniel's desire, whether it's at the level of embodied desire physically, whether it's the desire to innovate and create, whether it's desire to share value in his kind of coaching, teaching, Aristotle practice, whether it's in a desire for creativity, whether it's in his aesthetic desire, all those desires are not local to Daniel. They're a unique expression of the larger field of desire.
Mm-hmm.
Or humanism.
Beautiful. To sharpen this up, so you're talking about a new story of value. What's the old story of value, or what's the current story of value?
That's great. And we'll come back to valid. I want to get back to that a little bit. But so the old story of value is I'm a separate self.
Mm-hmm.
Neo-Darwinian science, right? The world is ultimately random, ultimately pointless. There's no intrinsic meaning. There's wonder and beauty because we made it up and we decided it's wondrous and beautiful, but there's no intrinsic meaning. And that old story is the dominant paradigm. So I just want to give you an example just so you get a sense of this. This is not a kind of arcane issue in some textbook someplace. Let's take an example of my colleague, my friend who we passed by each other, but never directly. As I was doing a television show in the country he lives in, he was kind of probably a younger student at Hebrew U. But he wrote a book called Homo Sapiens, a book called Homo Deus. And Yuval, who, again, we've never met, and I'm sure Yuval, if you're listening, I'm sure he's a lovely man. And Yuval makes the unimaginably, what's a good word for it? Wrong. Let's just, there's a lot of other words I could use, but let's go for wrong, right? You know, claim, and he's not making it as a philosopher. He's not a philosopher. He's a good raconteur and a good popular historian, and I'm sure a very good man and an insightful man, but he's just repeating, he's parroting the standard zeitgeist narrative. And he says, I'll just give you two examples, just two simple examples. Chapter 2, Sapiens, clear implication. There's no essential difference between the destruction of human rights in Gaddafi's Libya, which is the example he uses, right, and universal human rights in Western democracies. Those are both just stories of value, which are, and I'm quoting directly, which are but, they're fictions, word one. Word two, figments of our imagination. Word two. Word three, social constructs. Now, that's an unimaginably, that's an amazing thing to say. Now, lots of postmodern professors say that. That's not the point. But the point is that Yuval's saying it. I'm just give you one more example, just so you see it's not aberrant. It's actually his basic position, right? In Homo Deus, he says, let me tell you a story. Chapter 7, he says, there's a kid who lives in England who's aroused by the priest, the Christian priest, to go to the Middle East to murder Muslims. Then it's like 7 centuries later, and the local, you know, whoever it is in the same area in England from which this kid was aroused 7 centuries ago, you know, he's kind of the same kid 7 centuries later, as it were, is kind of excited to go and work for Amnesty International right, in the same Middle East. He says, quite directly, there's no intrinsic difference between those two stories, right? Meaning there's no intrinsic difference in terms of the integrity of the values at stake. There's no evolution of value, right? These are all figments of our imagination.
Social, it's arbitrary.
Right? Now, here's where it gets shocking. So the fact that Yuval would write that, and Brother Yuval, the fact that you would write that, I'm going to say it to you directly, total good. Like, whatever, have a nice day, right? But the fact that on the back of the book, you have Barack Obama, and you have a president of the United States saying, this is great. Bill Gates, you know, the head of Amazon, right? And I'll list, I mean, I could list, you know, 25 people who said, wow, this tells our story. This is great. So that means you have the mainstream, right, of culture saying there's no intrinsic value with no one batting an eyelash.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, meaning it's a non-event. So that's the old story. The old story is I'm a separate self. There's no intrinsic value. Doesn't exist. Right? That's the postmodern story. Right? And even the modern story, starting from David Hume, in the modern story, we pretend modernity has two major streams, which we talk about in the First Principles and First Values book. But the dominant stream in modernity, which comes from David Hume, basically pretends like there's intrinsic value, but actually doesn't know how to source it. Mm-hmm. Even the deists, you know, kind of where they're kind of between two positions, they say it's self-evident, right? Mm-hmm. Well, what's your source of value? It's self-evident. But really what's happening is modernity is barring social capital from pre-modernity. And the social capital is value is real. And then post-modernity comes along and calls in the loan. You can't do that, right? Actually, this is not real. And there's this utter deconstruction of any field of value. Postmodernity, which becomes the dominant force, which Harari is expressing, right, in those books that are so widely popular and so well endorsed, right, is basically saying, right, there is no Tao. There is no field of value. Now, once that's true, so you have no basis of actually countering either the death of humanity or the death of our humanity, because right. You have no field of value, right, which will actually create something that is as powerful as jihad. Jihad is the jihad in its public form, not in its beautiful interior form as this internal struggle for wholeness, but in its kind of current political form. Jihad is an expression of the ethnocentric, brutal hijacking of the field of value, in which only my people, Dar el Harb and Dar el Islam, only my people are inside the field of value and everyone else can be massacred. Putin's assumption, right? And all of his advisors, all of his, meaning many of his key advisors are well-versed in postmodernism. And they're basically saying, you know, there's no intrinsic field of value. There's Mother Russia, which they've set up as a kind of myth for kind of a pure power grab on multiple levels. As if there's no field of value, there's nothing by which we can actually evaluate history and actually set direction. There's nothing to cohere open societies. And an open society can only be coherent if it's held together by this new attractor, which is a shared field of value. Otherwise, and maybe this is the last sentence and turn back to you, brother, but let's just think about it. We have these global challenges. Global challenges, to meet them, require global coordination. But global coordination, number three, requires global coherence.
Mm-hmm.
which requires number four, global resonance. We need resonance between us. And there's only resonance between us, back to your date, right, if there's intimacy. So you need global intimacy. And we're facing a global intimacy disorder, which is based on how do you create intimacy in a couple or in an organization? Shared value. So the global intimacy disorder is based on a breakdown in a field of shared value. So therefore, if you do a reverse engineering, it's very simple and elegant and tragic, and it brings us towards what's possible. So the breakdown in the field of shared value, a grammar of value, creates a intimacy disorder, which creates a breakdown of global resonance, which means there's no global coherence, which means we have no global coordination to respond to global challenges. Meta crisis, which right. is why a new story of value is actually the only effective response to the meta crisis. And that's what Da Vinci understood in Florence, right? When he said, oh my God, the pre-modern medieval world is breaking down, right? Yes, I can do new infrastructure. And he was very involved in infrastructure and science. And we can try and create a new social structure, but all that's going to be based on something much more fundamental, which is a new superstructure. I'm borrowing terms from Marvin Harris, meaning a new story of value, a new worldview. It's only a new story that can actually evolve the source code of history. And by the way, I would say that's the major thing that Yuval and I agree on. Right.
So
right.
I have two follow-ups before we get into what is value and what this new story is. I had a question here, which was, why do you think the Yuval Harari perspective is so popular among like modern Western elites? Like, what is it that's so attractive about that? I have some of my own theories, but I'm curious what you'd say to that.
First off, I'd love to hear your theories, but I think it's for a very simple reason, and they're correct, is because, and this is something that the New Age thinkers and the human potential thinkers all ignore, which is why human potential thought and New Age thought hasn't actually done what it might have done, right? And pre-modern thought, meaning various forms of fundamentalism, also ignore this. So it's ignored in the bastions of the left and in the right, which is there was actually a devastating critique of value in modernity.
Yeah.
Modernity, right, leveled, and we'll talk about what that is when we get to value, but it leveled a devastating critique of value so that people like, for example, B.F. Skinner at Harvard, who reigns at Harvard for six decades, and he writes, I think I have it here, I've been looking at his work quite intensely, it's all right behind me, right? He writes about, you know, Skinner writes about the collapse of value, and in his book Beyond Freedom and Dignity, 1971, he repeats what he talks about in his book Walden 2, 1947, which is his utopian novel. What he basically writes is, there is no field of value because, he says, we have received and accepted the veracity of, he doesn't say these words, but it's implicit, the devastating critique of value theory in modernity. So now he says, he takes it as a given. And now we all know that value is not real. That's a given. There's a someone just sent me a book by, you know, a young man, Nadav Ayal. Actually, a friend of Yuval's, I think, in Israel. Clinton kind of helped with the book, and it's called The Global Revolt, right? And it's one of those, you know, good book. And it was a reporter, intelligent young man, and you know, maybe 50, and he writes, this is almost a direct quote: "We all know that there's no such thing as preordained and eternal value."
Mm.
That's like a given. He's like,
right. That's a starting point.
That's the starting point. So in other words, now, they're not wrong. And one of the things that we try and address, and I've spent the last decade, right, on value theory. You know, that's what Zach and Ken and I were talking about. You know, we did about 12 conversations to try and work this out. But basically, in a word, if we were to do like a huge move in a word, basically, what postmodernity and postmodernity said is, how can you say that there are preordained and eternal values? There's evolution. It's always changing. And so someone like my dear friend, who's a fellow at our think tank with Zach and I at the Center for World Philosophy and Religion, right? Howard Bloom, who's a great guy.
Mm-hmm. I've had him on the podcast.
Right. Howard's a great guy. And Howard writes an epic book called The Lucifer Principle. And he actually has written a new book. Howard and I have been talking every other week for the last 7 years or so. an intense conversation. We're going to actually be publishing at the World Philosophy and Religion Press, right, his new book, and we'll write a whole introduction to it and how it relates to our work on the science side. But bracket that for a second. So Howard writes in The Lucifer Principle, he epitomizes the postmodern critique of value, right? Howard says, love, and I'm not giving his exact words, but the basic argument is love. You call love something that's real. 1,500 years ago, you loved in a particular religion. That means you massacred everyone in the next town. And you call that love. Today, you massacre everyone, you go to jail forever, right? Unless you're in a... So he's saying basically everyone's using the word love, but everyone's making up what it means. It doesn't actually mean anything. It's a social construct. That is Howard repeating, right, the eloquently, as Howard always does, right? And he's a beautiful man, in it repeating the critique of value, which is correct, right? In other words, the notion that value is preordained, right, and eternal in the sense of unchanging is actually not true. But now here's where it gets very beautiful. And it's subtle, it's beautiful, it's gorgeous. And this is a bigger conversation. We talk about this in First Principles and First Values, but it needs its own volume, which we're going to hopefully give it. But in a word, actually, love is real. Love actually means something. And when we do these 18 interior science equations, for example, the Eros equation, Eros is love. And we're saying Eros equals, Eros means something all the way up and all the way down. Eros is the experience of radical aliveness, desiring deeper contact and greater wholeness. That's always what love means. Now, how you experience love will evolve, right? So there's an evolution of love.
Mm-hmm.
So value is real. It's eternal. Eternal not in the sense that it doesn't change. Eternity in Wittgenstein's sense of eternity, that which is beneath space and time, right? It's intrinsic value. So there's eternal value, which is also evolving value. In other words, evolving in eternal. And when this became clear to me, right, I didn't sleep for several nights. Because it reinterprets everything. In other words, the eternal Tao is the evolving Tao.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Love is both eternal. It's a value beneath and beyond time, and yet it evolves through time. So I'll just give you one simple example, my friend. So in my life, I can be a lover, and my love is egocentric. Me and my survival people. Then I expand and I say, wow, no, it's not just me and my survival people, it's me and my tribe. That might be a good expansion, a positive ethnocentrism, right? Mm-hmm. Meaning I'm an American patriot, not a right-wing xenophobe, right? So we've also lost the word patriotism. No, I'm a patriot, right? I'm willing to die for my country. It's a big deal, right? Mm-hmm. Right? My son, who has been fighting the last 4 months, has lost 10 good friends in the last 10 months, you know, fighting for a set of principles and values, right? It's a big deal, right? So ethnocentric means I'm willing to sacrifice. I have a felt sense of intimacy and care and concern with my whole tribe. But then I say, no, that's too narrow. I'm world-centric. I've now gone from egocentric to ethnocentric to world-centric. We are the world, 1985, Live Aid concert, right? In other words, every human being on the face of the earth, I'm willing to lay it down for and to sacrifice for. And I have a felt sense of care and concern for every human being. I'm ethnocentric, but I'm world-centric, excuse me, but I still eat hamburgers, right? I still eat hamburgers. And I still eat hamburgers means, even though I'm world-centric, I still slaughter animals in concentration camp conditions because my love doesn't extend to animals. Right. It's only world-centric, right? So then I go to the next step. I'm cosmocentric. I actually have a sense of felt care and concern for every living being and maybe for the whole evolutionary process. So that's the evolution of love. I just went from egocentric to ethnocentric to world-centric to cosmocentric, right? That's an evolving love story. And I kept expanding my circle of care and concern.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one vector. There's about five different vectors in the evolution of love, which we won't go through all of now. That's one example of love means something, and it evolves, both. So the core of first principles and first values of the new story of value is that there is a field of value, and love is real, and we know love is real. And that's the moment you were describing before when I actually experience love or whatever the value is, my life is valid, right? It makes sense. And valid is, of course, the same Latin root of value, right? It's like, wow. And it's what makes a hero who's filled with valor or valiance. Remember Prince Valiant when we were growing up, Valiant, is because the hero participates and feels the field of value and is willing to act even at risk to her own life or his own life for the sake of the whole. Because the heroes in the field of value, you know, when you watch that movie 20 years ago of Tom Hanks Saving Private Ryan, right? It's an old movie, and you see all these kids on the beach of Normandy storming the beach, knowing that half of them are going to be killed. They're in the field of value, right? They understand that there's a larger field and they're heroes, right? Which is why in the middle of postmodernity, as we're trying to reclaim value, right? Marvel Comics explodes, hero movies. Got in my friend, we've only met a couple of times, a beautiful man, Avi Arad, right, who he came to a couple of classes I was giving in LA, but he's a very, very beautiful man, Israeli guy, right, who buys Marvel Comics, right, and creates all these hero movies. And what he's doing is he's not doing it intentionally, he's not a philosopher, but in his body he's saying, no, there is value. Yeah. Right? And let me tell you a hero story, and let me tell you a new hero story, which is beautiful. And the hero's more imperfect and more subtle and more evolving, and there's more of a Leonard Cohen, a holy and a broken hallelujah. It's not a pristine Superman, right? Thor is much more complex, and the Avengers are much more complex than Superman ever was on a good day. But the hero participates in the field of value. So therefore, the hero is filled with valor and valere, which is strength, and valentine, right? Valentius, which is eros, love. So eros is beautiful, valentius, and value, right, creates the sense of valor and the intrinsic valiance, right, which self-validates my life. That's what the field of value does. Without that, there's no move.
I have two follow-ups for this. I feel like...
Please, brother.
So kind of coming back to that first question of like, why is the Yuval Harari perspective so popular? I think like a related question is like, why are we so vulnerable to bad ideas of value? Given, you know, the way you're speaking about this, it sounds like very obvious in a way. It's like, yeah, it's like the field of value is there. It's intrinsic. It's part of the cosmos. So why is it that like a few French intellectuals and, you know, some popular history books or whatever can shape the culture against what is otherwise so obvious?
Because their critique was correct. It was true, but partial. In other words, pre-modernity, the traditional world said, A, value is eternal and unchanging, and B, it belongs only to us. So it was A, value is eternal, and B, my ethnocentric context owns all value.
Right.
Along comes modernity and says, fuck your ethnocentric context, get lost. And there's this thing called evolution, so you're wrong on both counts.
And then they threw the baby out with the bathwater.
Right. And what I just described to you was 20 years of thought stated simply, meaning what we actually did is, and I want to say this gently and tenderly and with so much trembling and joy, we actually solved value theory. What I just described to you was what I did with Zach and Ken is we actually cracked value theory. And it's the first time it's, I think, been well articulated. This is not articulated what I'm sharing with you, right? You can't just claim intrinsic value. That doesn't get you anywhere. Mm-hmm. That's a pre-modern claim. You claim intrinsic value, modernity looks at you and rolls their eyes.
What was the critical move that helped you unlock value theory?
That something can be eternal and evolving at the same time.
Right, right.
In other words, that value is not preordained and eternal in the sense of being unchanging. Value is eternal in the sense of being intrinsic and evolving. So Can I share with you something? Can we go like crazy deep for 1 minute? Yep.
Let's do it.
Okay, crazy deep. So I'm going to tell you where. Let's kind of root this very deep in the lineages, and particularly in the lineage of Solomon. So there's a third century text about this battle between these two titans, you know, of Eros and intellect and mind. And one's called Joshua, and the other's called Eliezer. And they're arguing about a point of the word of God. How do you read divine law? And this is in the Talmud. It's a third century text. It appears in a tractate, a tome called Baba Metzia, that happens to be the name of it. And it's on page 59A, and it starts at the bottom line of the page. Anyone wants to look it up, you can look it up and Google it. So Eliezer says, this is the divine law. This is what God is saying, reading these, you know, sacred texts. And Joshua says, no, that's not true. And Eliezer says, huh, you think that's not true? I am going to show you a miracle. I am going to make the water of this little river here flow backwards. And so the water flows backwards, right? And Joshua says, we don't bring evidence from water that flows backwards. And Eliezer says, really? I'm going to give you another piece of evidence that I'm right, that my reading of the divine law is right. He says, what's your evidence? He says, let the walls of the study hall fall in on themselves. So the walls are about to fall in, and Joshua says, no, don't fall in. And then the walls are confused who to honor, so they kind of remain half in, half out. Finally, Eliezer says, you know what? Just to show you I'm right, a voice from heaven, a divine, eternal voice will emerge and tell you that the law is like me, that I'm reading the divine law properly. So the text reads, I'm going to say it in its original form, Yatza Batkol, but a divine voice comes out from heaven and says, Halacha Kereb Eliezer, Eliezer's right. Joshua, you would think that's the end of the conversation. God just said he was right. Eternity just said he was right. So the text reads, Kam Rabbi Yeshua al Raglav. Joshua stands up on his feet, right? You can imagine the scene. And he says, Lo b'shamayim hi, eternity is not in heaven. We determine the law. Mm. Now, that's a shocking and beautiful text, because that text is not a liberal Protestant text, you know, in the 18th century post-Enlightenment world. That is a third century text, deep within the lineage of Solomon. What the text is saying is that the eternal voice of value evolves. And it evolves through the prism of the clarified human being who participates in its evolution. That's a shocking statement. And when I was in Dharamsala a bunch of years ago, it's a long and different story. Dalai Lama had taken a particular prayer instrument of mine because we had an argument at the Pope's summer residence. It's a long story. He took it and he said to me through his messenger, said, come to Dharamsala to get it back, which is a pain in the ass, but I did. So I'm in Dharamsala, and you know, he asks me kind of where, you know, we had a wonderful, you know, time together. He's a beautiful man. And he basically says, like, and we called it, it was a conversation between Jerusalem and Tibet. And he says to me, and remember, he's experiencing exile, right? They've been exiled now from Tibet. He's in Dharamsala. You know, he said to me, I go to the West because they're nicer to me than they are in Dharamsala. Right? Mm. You know, in other words, he's actually having quite a hard time within the internal Buddhist world. There's an enormous amount of politics and opposition to him on multiple levels. So he says, so how did the lineage of Solomon survive? Right? And I cited for him this text, which is about it doesn't use the word evolution, it's third century, but it's about eternal and evolving value. That actually, on the one hand, the field of value is intrinsic and real. Both Joshua and Eliezer agree that they're in a field of value together. And yet, that field of value is mediated through the human heart, the clarified human heart and soul, which then evolves the value. And so at some point I realized, oh, this is not a local issue within the Talmudic dialectics of the lineage of Solomon. They're actually saying something unbearably important, which is what allowed the lineage of Solomon to survive.
Right.
Right? In other words, when it was exiled 2,000 years ago and it had no common land anymore and had no common language, right, and no political power, and was dispersed kind of pretty much every place, right, and was fairly hated, they weren't too popular, right, you know, and you're gone, I mean, Toynbee says 150 years of that state, you disappear from history. No one's ever survived. And Toynbee says, what about the lineage of Solomon? How did they survive? He says, I don't know. Right. Basically, right.
So they updated. They weren't dogmatically stuck with their preordained definitions of value.
So, yes. And let me, with permission, brother, they understood that the eternal is evolving. It's very beautiful. Right? And if the field of value is real, it's not contrived. It's not merely a social construct, right? It's not a fiction, right? And it's not a figment of our imagination. It's absolutely real and absolutely evolving. And evolution and eternity moved from in my mind, heart, and body, emerged from the lineage and from other sources, but I'm giving you just one take. Eternity and evolution, I realized, wasn't a contradiction, but a paradox, right? It's both eternal and evolving at the same time. And we actually know in our bodies that that's true. Now,
so I want to jump in here.
Please.
Because before we end, I'd love to ask this question. If somebody is listening to this, and let's say they're not as philosophically oriented, or they're probably not going to vibe with like a really rigorous account of this story,
totally.
What's some way that you can prompt the intuition? And maybe they're a little skeptical too. How could you prompt this intuition for people to recognize that value is real, recognize that that love is real, and that there is some sort of internal process that you're talking about?
Okay, great. So the two things. One, Tom Hanks is always helpful, just to say. Thank you. Thank you, Tom. Right? So a little bit after Saving Private Ryan, right? This was in my movie stage. I was doing a television show and we were analyzing texts of movies. So I watched Castaway. Mm-hmm. Another Tom Hanks movie where this gentleman is, Tom Hanks is stuck on an island somewhere in the, wherever it is. It's a beautiful island. He's learned how to survive. He's got the near Darwinian stuff down, right? He can survive there forever. And he says, fuck this. I got to get the hell out of here. And he uses his blood to paint a face on a Wilson basketball because he needs face to face. He needs security, means he needs Eros. He needs love. And he basically's got, you know, 2% chance of making a raft and throwing it into the ocean and surviving. And he does it anyways because his love is real, right? Right? Because Eros is actually not, it's not a social contrivance, right? It's cross-cultural. It's across every culture. It's across all times, right? It's the primary topic of all music, right? It's all love songs, all the way up and all the way down. But that tells you something. It tells you love is real. It's not created by a particular culture. It's not a social contrivance. We live or die for it, right? Because, you know, I was just saying to KK, you know, we last night we had some, you know, she's making a movie. So we were working on the movie. And we had some, you know, disagreement about where to look for a particular clip that she was looking for. And we just had, I would say, like, maybe like a moment of like discord. Mm-hmm. Like, didn't we find that 6 weeks ago? And why didn't you write it down? Now it's going to take us 16 more years. We had this moment of discord. And all of a sudden we felt not at home in the world until we write. And others just like, who cares if we're having this little disagreement? But actually, when you choose, no, this, I'm really loving you and you're really loving me and we're in discord, I'm not at home in the world. And we actually know the feeling. It's why falling in love, when we fall in love, we're like, oh, okay, I'm being personally addressed by reality. I'm at home in the world. Right? I feel at home in the world when I fall in love because reality is a love story. Right? And that's not because it's a contrived social construct. Not because I've handled some status issues. No, actually, wow, right, here I am. And then I also realize it didn't start with me. This has always been true. When I read all the literature, all the way back, when I read the literature in every part of the world, all the way back and all the way forward, it's all a love story. And that love story evolves. Of course. And that's the crazy thing. And I love your inquiry. The deepest philosophical realization, the deepest, let me get that word right, philosophical realization is the most obviously apparent in our immediate knowing. That's what's such a paradox. We actually all know this. The academy got lost. Mm-hmm. Now again, you know, I did my doctorate at Oxford, right? You know, I spend my life reading philosophy and kind of classical text. So I have great honor for the philosophical tradition. And I'm surrounded by, you know, myself and Zach, you know, have in different ways read as much, if you put our two swaths of it together, it's pretty broad swath, right? You know, kind of So it's not that we don't honor that tradition, but what happened in the academy was the academy, the general mainstream academy, got lost in a dogmatic, reductive materialism out of which it didn't know how to reconstruct an intrinsic field of value, and it could not find its way out, right? So if you read, for example, B.F. Skinner, who we talked about before, in his book Walden 2, his assumption is love is not real. His assumption is the same one as Howard Bloom, the Lucifer Principle. Love is completely contrived. Therefore, we control it invisibly through technologies of control. And Skinner was picked up by the MIT Media Lab, which actually based their entire structure of designing the web on Skinnerian principles. And Zach and I finished a book called Turning the World into a Skinner's Box, analyzing, right, the precise 23 parallel structures between what governs the MIT Media Lab and Skinner, right? Because they both assume, when you read Sandy Pentland, who was the founder of the MIT Media Lab, let's say, for example, his book, 2014, Social Physics, it's very clear that the MIT Media Lab believes that love is a pure social construct. It's not real at all. Because, not because he's a bad guy, and he doesn't have horns. It's not my dear friend Russell Brand. It's not a conspiracy. It's that, no, he actually has no way to articulate love is real. Steven Pinker has no way to articulate love is real because they swallowed, as a kind of dogmatic given, the critique of value that reigned and reigns in the academy. And so what we've done is not first principles and first values. Is not about a clever book. It's actually a digest of this entire revisioning of value theory, which, as you pointed out so beautifully, Daniel, you can actually explain it very clearly. In other words, I did kind of a number of levels of explanation here, but actually you just know in your body, actually, I'm a hero. I want to be a hero. Be a hero means I'm in the field of value. You cannot be here without being in the field of value. Do you remember that movie Barbie that just came out?
Yeah, I haven't seen it though.
Oh, God. So the whole point of the Barbie movie is there's no hero. Because there's no field of value. Because not this Barbie doesn't love this Ken. There is no love story. There's no cosmorotic universe. If there's no cosmorotic universe, there can't be a hero, which is why, if you notice in the literature, postmodernity rejects the hero.
Right. Right?
This book we just happened to talk about before, just before we went online, The End of Men by Hanna Rosin. One of the themes in this book, and by the way, can you imagine writing a book in yellow and pink called The End of Women and see how far that gets you? Just let's bracket that issue, okay?
Right.
Subtle, right, masculine demonization. But a major theme in this book is the rejection of the male hero. The male hero is a problematized masculine egoic structure. But actually, the hero is not man or woman. The hero is the experience that I'm standing for the larger field of value, which is beautiful. And which we all know in and of ourselves, and the emergence of a new human and a new humanity, what we call the move from Homo sapien to Homo amor, is the democratization of the hero. That I actually participate in the field of value. I affect the field of value. My transformation is the transformation of the whole. I'm omni-considered and omni-responsible for the sake of the whole. That can respond to the meta-crisis. That's a new story of value.
So final question, just to close.
Hey, brother, yeah.
If someone's listening to all this and they're inspired, how do you think, what are some ideas for how it might practically change the way they show up with people today or tomorrow? Like very, very concretely, how might this show up in someone's life?
Okay. Two examples. One, the way you do relationship, right? So the first way we did a relationship was what roommates. We want to have kids together, work it out. We each do our jobs, right? Then we went kind of in the mid-60s to soulmates. We want to look deeply in each other's eyes. But actually, those both are true but partial. They don't hold. Relationship collapses if you're just looking deeply in each other's eyes because at a certain point, don't say this out loud, you're bored out of your mind, right? So what you have to do is you have to be looking at a shared horizon and then turn to look deeply in each other's eyes. We call that wholemate, right? Whole means I'm omniconsiderate for the sake of the whole. We're looking at the whole together. So if I'm actually homo amor, we have to actually, in order to decide that we're going to become together in a relationship, we don't come together just because we have great sex, because that's going to wear out rather soon, and that it's only going to remain gorgeous sexuality, strangely enough, if we're in the field of value together, right? And we like dancing, okay, good Italian food together, great. But the reason I come together is not because, I come together because we're living together in a shared field of value, and we have a shared horizon of the whole. That completely changes the way I do relationship.
Yeah, that's beautiful.
Right? So that's one, just one, but it's very direct. And it actually, it's a complete Copernican shift in how I do relationship. Do I do relationship as separate self, role mate, or separate self, role mate? And this is what modernity did. And we gave you a booby prize to make you not realize what's going on. And we called it romance, right? So we said, no stories are real, but we'll give you a romantic story just to kind of keep you occupied. And that soulmate, okay, I'm going to basically turn away from the world and just look deeply in your eyes. But that doesn't last. It doesn't work. Mm-hmm. So, for example, I mean, it's just a quick example, and maybe we can finish with this one. Because we'll focus on one example instead of two because it's so deep. So it's 1970, before you were born, okay? And there's a huge movie that flips all around the Western world, and it's called Love Story. It's like this famous epic movie. I think it was Ryan O'Neal and Ally McGraw, right? And I was, you know, just barely peeping around. And in this movie, it's about these two individuals. There's no larger context. There's no larger whole. It's their story, and it's their pathos and their wounds and their trauma. And that was the big move from roommate to soulmate, right? We're going to share wounds and trauma. And fast forward 30 years later, my friend Lana, who was then Larry, right, makes a movie which she calls The Matrix. Neo and Trinity, their first meeting, is completely different than the first meeting between Jenny and Oliver in Love Story. Jenny and Oliver in Love Story, they meet and they say, "Oh, you preppy," and they make fun of each other, and it's this cute banter which has nothing to do with anything other than their personal idiosyncrasies and lives. When Neo and Trinity meet, right, Trinity says to Neo, says, "We're asking the same question." Mm. Right? We're in the same search. Right? And they have, Neo and Trinity have this very deep soulmate relationship. They're madly in love. And yet, they have a vision. They have a mission. And so when the death scene in Love Story, she says to him, you know, Jenny, to Oliver, "Promise me you won't feel guilty," and you'll whatever. Right? Trinity says to Neo, first, "Oh my God, I remember our kiss. It was the most beautiful thing in my life. And complete the mission."
Mm-hmm.
It's a different story. Right? Neo and Trinity. So in other words, wholemate. Right? Homo amoris wholemate in the field of value together. It utterly transforms how we do relationship. Shah?
I'll just say one thing. This brings up an image to mind that I learned in church when I was a kid.
Yeah.
Which is to conceptualize like husband and wife. It was to see a triangle where at the point of it is God. And so by moving closer to God, you also move closer to each other. Like if you imagine geometrically the nodes of the triangle coming together. And so putting God, or like the highest conception of wholeness, right in the center of the relationship completely transforms how you relate to each other.
Right. And notice, I mean, and this is such a perfect place for us to conclude, because notice, so Daniel grows up, and the place where this is available is in church.
Mm.
Right. And what we're saying is, and we have to do a whole podcast on God, but let's just say the God you don't believe in doesn't exist. Right. So there's this small God, you know, and often when someone says, "I don't believe in God," I'll say, "Describe to me God." And I'll say, "Wow, the God you don't believe in, I don't believe in either."
Mm-hmm.
Right. So bracket that for a second. But what we're saying is, if God is anything, God is the intrinsic nature of the field of value that we're intimate with. And the name of God that we're using in cosmotic humanism, which just crystallized, she just kind of whispered it in our ears in the last 6 months, is God is the infinite intimate.
Mm-hmm.
the infinite intimate, right? The infinity of value intimately available in the immediacy of my lived life. That's a story of value, which is an intrinsic story of cosmos that can live in China and can live in Russia and can live in South America and can live all across red states and blue states, that no one owns, that has nothing to do with Zach Stein or Ken Wilber or Mark Goffney. David J. Temple is ushering it in, and we should all be long forgotten, and the field of value should live, and we should create a future, right? And that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to create a memory of the future, which is this field of value, because hope is a memory of the future. Shaw?
Beautiful. Mark, yeah. Thank you so much for this conversation today.
Yeah, thank you. What a delight.